60 years ago this month, British publisher Jonathan Cape put out a novel about a secret agent, a nefarious villain, and a casino. Casino Royale marked the birth of...
The name's Bond. James Bond.
And popular culture has never been the same. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we're talking with two of James Bond's biggest fans about the fictional British spy. Michael Van Blaricum is president of the Ian Fleming Foundation, dedicated to preserving Bond-related memorabilia, some of which is coming to the University of Illinois this month. Joining him is John Court, a filmmaker who made many of the documentary segments included in James Bond movie DVDs. Together, they know a lot about James Bond, Ian Fleming, and why Agent 007 is still saving the world after 60 years. That's all coming up on Focus after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This weekend, the University of Illinois is marking the 60th anniversary of the debut of James Bond in a big way, with several events and displays under the general title of The Birth of Bond, Casino Royale at 60. Our guests on the program today are a big part of the event and big fans of James Bond. Michael Van Blaricum earned his degrees in electrical engineering at the University of Illinois. He's president of the Ian Fleming Foundation, and it is his collection that is to a large part on display at the U of I as part of this event. Dr. Van Blaricum, welcome to Focus.
Thanks, Jim.
And our other guest today is John Cork. He made many of the documentary segments that you'll see on many James Bond home video releases. As a matter of fact, I recently watched a DVD of the 1967 spoof version of Casino Royale, and John Cork is one of the people on the commentary track. John Cork will be coming to the U of I Urbana campus in 2 weeks to take part in a James Bond film festival. He joins us now on the phone. John Cork, welcome to Focus.
It's good to be here.
Well, you know, I can understand being a big fan of James Bond because there are people who are big fans of lots of things, but why do you think, and maybe I can start with you, Michael, why do you think James Bond has been so endearingly popular for 60 years?
Well, primarily because of the girls, I think, and the girls in the movies, that is. And I always like to say one reason is the way Fleming brought James Bond to life is basically he never described him. So James Bond could be any man. But I think a lot of people identify with him. That's the world they want to live in. They'd really like to be that way. But I have to admit, John Cork's the one that wrote the book on the legacy of James Bond. So I suspect he has a...
And, John, you've looked at a lot of James Bond movies just in your work. What can you tell me? Why are we still watching these movies and reading these books?
Well, I think the core element for me is that Fleming came along with an iconic character that was significantly different than the type of hero characters that had come before him. And when you have a character that captures very perfectly part of our sort of temporal experience in the world and the way that we wish the world was, it will stay with us. Sherlock Holmes was the master of logic. We could solve a problem with our brain. Tarzan, which has its own weird sort of racist elements to it in certain respects, but it was the man can overcome nature and become part of nature as well as we were moving into a more industrialized society. And James Bond became someone who in the post-World War II universe could look at good and evil and not get caught up into the sort of endless political debates about something. Could be sort of the knife that cut the Gordian knot of a problem, and that the villains that he was attacking are villains that are very representative of you know, the great societal sins. Fleming was fascinated by the seven deadly sins, and so he's taking on unbridled greed with Goldfinger. He's taking on people who are just angry with the world with a character like Dr. No. People who are bored and indifferent to human suffering, like Ernst Stavro Blofeld. So you have not only a great character who represents all of the things that in the post-World War II world that the Soviets were saying were wrong with the West, someone who indulges in luxury items and beautiful libidinous sex or libidinous sex with beautiful women, who's indulging in brand items and consumerism to a large degree, and yet he can be portrayed as a hero, and so he embodies what we were being told were our societal sins, and battling things that frustrated us about the world. And he still does that, and I think that's the reason that he's endured so much.
Is he the same James Bond now? I mean, if we go out and watch Skyfall, the latest James Bond movie, are we seeing the same elements that Ian Fleming put into Casino Royale 60 years ago?
Mike, do you want to start with that, or do you want me to?
I'll go ahead and start, and then you can fill in with the right answers. I think the new movies... certainly the 2006 Casino Royale that introduced Daniel Craig as James Bond really did follow the James Bond style that Ian Fleming created back and first published in 1953, he created it in 1952. And I think they've kept that. James Bond, Ian Fleming made James Bond a blunt instrument of society. Again, he was out to save the British Empire from the world's sins. And I think we've seen that carried through. I don't think we see the comic book, any of the comic book elements that we saw for a while. So the current James Bond, as it's being produced, I believe, really is very close to Ian Fleming's James Bond.
And I'll add on to that I think that the reason that Bond has been successful for as long as he has been successful is this ability to take the character and morph him with the times. And so that I think that at any given point in the series, you can look at a successful Bond film, and there have been some that have not really, captured audiences and held their attention, but the ones that have broken through and been the big successes, and that's been a majority of them, they always have a strong link back to Fleming, even the comic book ones. But those links are different, because Fleming wrote a very seemingly simple but strangely complex character that has all sorts of internal contradictions and dichotomies going on there that Fleming doesn't explore like an author, say, like James Joyce or someone like that. He explores in a very surface way. And so it becomes easier for filmmakers, screenwriters, and directors to interpret that character through their own lens, and for an actor to do so as well. I think there's a lot of Fleming that goes on in Daniel Craig's performances.
Well, we're talking about James Bond today on Focus, and we welcome you to the conversation as well. If you have some questions or comments about the James Bond phenomenon, call 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And Michael, we're here because of the displays and events going on here on campus. Tell us about this collection and some of the items that people are going to see here at the U of I this month.
Sure. What's really fun about what's going to happen starting tomorrow is that the displays are actually at three different venues on campus. The Rare Book and Manuscript Library has eight display cases plus a lot of display panels on the books, and in particular the history of Casino Royale itself as a book, the publishing history, and what led Fleming up to that time to write it, what was in his background. The Sousa Archives and Center for American Music over in the Harding Band Building will be focusing on the music of James Bond, and in particular the music from the films of James Bond. And in one of the really interesting things they're going to have is David Arnold, who wrote the music for the 2006 Casino Royale, and Quantum of Solace, I believe, actually sent his manuscript or his score for Casino Royale to the library. So we have that for a full year. It's going to be on display. But there's also the record albums and the sheet music and all that. Then you go over to Spurlock, and Spurlock's museum is going to be focusing on the films. They have a display case, and in particular, they're going to be focusing on the different films, different meaning. For example, the first two Casino Royales that were made were not made by Yen Productions. There was a 1954 Casino Royale that was a TV show for Climax. There was a 1967 Casino Royale that was a Charles K. Feldman spoof, basically, of Casino Royale. And they're going to focus on Never Say Never Again, which is a remake of Thunderball. So they have displayed.
I remember that movie, and one thing I remember, I don't remember anybody saying it was a remake of Thunderball at the time.
Not on purpose, because it was a different set of producers that were doing it. In fact, they were going toe to toe with Eon Productions, who produced another movie at the time. And so I don't think anybody necessarily wanted to go back and say, hey, this is just a remake.
And for those of you who haven't seen it, Never Say Never Again does star Sean Connery, but by then he was no longer associated with the producers of the larger Bond series.
That's true. And there are display cases that actually have costumes from Never Say Never Again. They have Sean Connery size 14 shoes that he used in the opening sequence. But also we have Eon Productions is very kind and sent us costumes and props from the 2006 Daniel Craig film, which includes a bloody tuxedo. It actually includes three props that have never been on display before. And in the lobby, there will be an Aston Martin Volante, not from any of those films, but from The Living Daylights. But nevertheless, it's a pretty fun thing to see up close and personal.
Is that your Aston Martin now?
It's not mine. It's the Ian Fleming Foundation's Aston Martin.
And I want to get into that organization in a few minutes. This is the one that was used in the first of the Timothy Dalton Bond movies. And so is it a car that's current to the time when that movie was made?
Yes, it is. And this particular car is a special effects shell, meaning that, you know, when you stand and look at it, it'll look like a full-on Aston Martin Volante, but it was only used for one special effects sequence in there.
So it's not a drivable car.
That's true. It's completely empty.
But I wonder, I'm just curious, are there any aspects in the car of the special effects? Anything meant to pop out at the time?
Yes, the way it's set up, and the way it's set up in the Spurlock Museum, there's a ski. The special effect that this particular vehicle is used for, and which is what's sort of amazing about it, is the detail they went to just for a few seconds of the film. And they actually, in the film, you'll see a place where Bond gets the car in a position where he needs to use skis, pushes a button, and the skis extend from the side of the car. And this particular car has both skis extended on both sides.
We're talking about James Bond on Focus with Michael Van Blaricum of the Ian Fleming Foundation, and also John Cork, who will be here in town in a couple of weeks in connection with a James Bond Film Festival, which is in connection with the displays going on this month. And John, you've done a lot of work with the documentary segments. I was listening to your commentary track on the 67 Casino Royale. Besides the general character, do the Bond movies based directly on Fleming novels follow them closely?
Some do and some don't. I mean, I think that the filmmakers would probably say it's much easier when you're starting with the work of Fleming and the storyline of Fleming. But one of the things, you know, Fleming's great talent was this sort of barreling forward energy that he wrote with. Plotting often was not his greatest talent. He was not someone who wrote these sort of intricate Eric Ambler, you know, Michael Crichton type plots where there were little clues that you're following all around and interrelationships there. He wrote with a sort of journalist, great journalist forward thrust of energy. And so the filmmakers, you know, don't mind doing the same thing there, but they also don't mind trying to go in over the years and improve and adjust those plots so that the plot of Goldfinger, the film, is not that Goldfinger is going to remove all the gold from Fort Knox, which was just, you know, something that, you know, where are you going to go with it? It's a lot of stuff, and it's got to be moved on a lot of trucks. Instead, they came up with a much more clever plot where they could, in essence, reduce the value of that gold. So they were always, from the very beginning, the very early days, adjusting these plot lines that way. And then some of them, they don't have any problem coming up with totally new plots or taking a scene from one novel that wasn't used in that novel and placing it in a different film on that end. And that has caused problems at times where, in the case of Casino Royale, in particular, and Thunderball as well, where people who owned those rights outside of Eon said, you're going into our territory. You're using a scene that's really exclusive to our novel. And, you know, they've had some tough negotiations over what they can use and what they can't use. Now they control all the rights and don't have any problem with what they use. But that's, you know, the case back there.
We invite your phone calls and emails, and one has come in at will-talk@illinois.edu. It seems that some people are always certain about where we stand with the Bond movies, and David Urbana was telling us right off that Sean Connery is the best James Bond, and Ursula Andress is the best Bond girl. And is it Richard Kyle or Richard Kiel? Finally, I can get an authoritative correction on
this. It's Richard Kiel.
Richard Kiel is the best Bond villain. So says Dave and Urbana. These were all, all of them in more than one Bond movie. Ursula Andress in Dr. No, but also showing up again in the spoof Casino Royale. I don't know how many times Richard Kiel played Jaws.
Twice.
Just twice? Only twice?
Yeah.
Only twice. You only play Jaws twice.
And Sean Connery, of course, I guess four or five times in total. If
Sean Connery was seven times.
I'm glad I'm with people who know the exact numbers here. But they're three very iconic people from those movies. Do the two of you have favorites when it comes to those, that sort of thing?
Yes, I do. Until Casino, the 2006 Casino Royale came out, Sean Connery was always my favorite Bond. I think Sean Connery is still my favorite Bond because it's the first Bond I saw when I was 14. But I thought Daniel Craig just epitomized the Fleming Bond in the 2006 Casino Royale. And so I really, really like him.
And John, do you have a favorite here, or do you have to be officially neutral with the work you do with the movies?
Oh, I don't have to be officially neutral in any sense. Connery is the iconic Bond to me. I mean, I'm sitting here in my living room and I have two large posters up that have Sean Connery's image on them. But for me, I can look at any of the actors who played Bond and appreciate what they brought to the series. So that, and I've been fortunate enough to spend a little bit of time with each one of those actors in the main series. I never met David Niven, other than that, I've managed to meet all the other Bonds. And they're all people who can fill up a room. I mean, and that's a great quality to have that you want in a sort of male leading man star. And they do so with a different type of presence and energy and a sense of elan and all these things. But so each one of them brings certain things in there. There are times I'm in the mood to watch a film like Live and Let Die, and there are times I'm in the mood to watch a movie like Skyfall, and other times I want to watch something like Thunderball or Goldfinger. So it really depends on what mood I'm in and who I'm going to appreciate. But if I have to say a best Bond, Connery's the one who set the mold, and I think all the other actors would agree that they wouldn't have had a job if Connery hadn't been so good at doing what he did.
We're going to take our first phone call now. This is line four, and good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I caught the tail end of the conversation, so you'll have to forgive me. But I do vote for, if it matters, I vote for obviously Sean Connery and then Goldfinger. Believe it or not, just to bring this full circle, about 25 years ago at least, got on the phone on a Chicago radio station with Siskel and Ebert, believe it or not, to discuss Bond films. So I had to call in this morning. But I'm in my mid-50s, and I haven't seen a Bond movie for a very long time, although everyone's telling me Skyfall is wonderful, so I'm going to have to revisit it. But it did seem to me that perhaps after Goldfinger or Thunderball, the series got somewhat cartoonish, especially with Roger Moore, and just kind of super unreal type of things were happening, and maybe that was part of the fun. But as a very young person, I can remember the merchandising that went on with the films, and I would love to have some of the Bond cars. I think they sold toy cars that were Bond cars, and just, you know, they had dolls like Odd Job and all that, and I would imagine that pretty much today they'd be worth a mint. But anyway, I just wanted to add that and leave that up for comment. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, and to comment just briefly on what he said, I mean, I would highly recommend if somebody walked away from the Bond film because they felt that the tone changed too much after the mid-1960s, where there was so much competition in the marketplace that Bond felt they had to be so much bigger than anyone else who was out there. I would strongly suggest coming back and looking at the Daniel Craig Bond films, you know, particularly if one was a fan of the Fleming novels on that end. And as to the merchandise has always been a big part of the Bond phenomenon, and there's some fascinating stories. Michael, even though his collection is primarily focused on the literary Bond, he has a collection that he sort of randomly assembled of the collectibles that is pretty absolutely remarkable. So
now the collectibles, Michael, what sort of collectibles are we dealing with here? Because Aston Martins aside,
well, my personal collection. As I said earlier, the Ian Fleming Foundation, which is a nonprofit foundation, owns 34 vehicles from the movies. But my personal collection, I think the thing that John was alluding to, I have collected a lot of various things. You know, the Sean Connery dolls, the Jaws dolls, the Odd Job dolls. But probably the thing I'm most proud of is in the 60s, Gilbert Toys, who was the biggest American toy company. The oldest American toy company. You know, they did the Erector set. They did all those things. They came out with a James Bond road race set, which the Sears Wish Book, the Christmas catalog, put in. It became the biggest selling toy in the history of the Sears Wish Book. It also put Gilbert Toys out of business. They had to go bankrupt.
How could something so popular put them out of business?
Well, they went overseas to have the road race set produced, and they had some quality control issues. So they had to, after they shipped, they found the problem and they had to reship and had to rebuild everything. So they basically, it cost them twice as much. I actually owned the copy. Marvin Glass was the designer. I actually own his copy, his design copy for that road race set. So it's not only iconic, but historic.
Yeah, and to put a sort of button on Michael's story here. What happened was is that, you know, Sears was just thrilled that these road race sets had sold until the first day open at a Sears after Christmas morning, because kids built these sets across America and the cars didn't run because the connections weren't working. And Marvin Glass, who designed the set, is one of the great American toy designers. So to have his original sculpted model of this road race set is really wonderful on that end. But most of those road race sets ended up in a landfill in New Jersey back in the 1970s, and a few were saved. But since they didn't work, nobody kept them. So there are very few copies of this out there, and, of course, only one of the actual, you know, hand-molded, hand-sculpted set, and it had a mountain and a tunnel and a place where the cars jumped, and it was spectacular. It just didn't work. And Gilbert Toys, they didn't survive ultimately.
And is that one of the items on display this month at the U of I?
No, it's not, unfortunately.
It's just for you to see.
at this point, yes.
Okay. Let me take another call from line one, Randall in Champaign. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes, hello. I'm remembering back to when I was 13 and Dr. No came out, and I proceeded on watching up until the age of 15, at which point I had always played around with firecrackers and explosives. But one of the things we did was we made pipe cannons back then. We probably shouldn't have, you know, but we did. But one of the things I did as a result of James Bond was I mounted a pipe cannon on my mother's 1962 Oldsmobile F-85 Cutlass. And I never did end up hooking it up. I just mounted the pipe only, and you could just see it sticking out just above the bumper. It's not very noticeable at all, but I don't know what happened. I either had enough sense to realize it might hurt someone, or I got interested in girls. But that was something that I did as a kid as a result of James Bond. So that's really all I have.
Well, I'm so glad you never hooked it up and fired it at anyone. You know, pipe cannons on cars often have the result of muzzle velocity that causes the projectile to go out and then eventually smash back into the car as it's moving. Yeah. So there's often, you know, a problem on that end. But the every few years you'll read an article in some newspaper about somebody who is actually decided they want to do, you know, create a gadget car sort of in the mold of James Bond. And these usually hit the news because they've either been arrested and are going to be facing some sort of horrible set of felony charges, or they've managed to severely injure themselves by attempting to do this. And
yeah. Well, I had enough sense not to do it.
I know. So I'm not, that speaks highly of it.
After I mounted the pipe. But anyway, that's what I had. So there you go.
Well, Randall, thank you very much for calling that in. And now I'm wondering, I'm trying to think if James Bond would have been the sort of person who, as a kid, put a pipe bomb on his mother's car. I've lost the word for it. Would have augmented his mother's car for the same way, or would he have discovered girls first?
I think James Bond, you know, you have to understand, he was somebody who was kicked out of Eton, the exclusive British boarding school where he was schooled for, as put, quote, trouble with a maid, housemaid. So I think we pretty much know where Bond fell on the rebellious territory at that point. It wasn't for making pipe cannons, but much more so for being having desires for the opposite sex and acting on them.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, saying that Bond was the user of the tools. It was certainly in the movies, Q was the engineer that created them. So Bond really was an engineer. But Randall, the last caller, pointed something out in a strange way that I experience all the time, which is almost everybody I ever talk to has a James Bond related story of some sort. Either that's the first time I heard of anybody putting a pipe bomb on their mother's car, or a pipe cannon on their mother's car. But you know, usually it's my first date with my wife, or you know, my dad. That's the first movie my dad took me to. That sort of thing. So everybody seems to have a memory, and this goes worldwide, not just in the United States.
Well, it's time for a short break. We'll be back with more about James Bond with John Cork and Michael Van Blaricum. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus with Michael Van Blaricum and John Cork talking about James Bond. Just a couple of days before the 60th anniversary of the original publication of the first James Bond novel, Casino Royale, the University of Illinois is hosting several events and displays this month to note that anniversary. You can find out more about them at a link at our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus and look for the link. And you can call us now to talk about James Bond at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And Michael Van Blaricum, you are the president of the Ian Fleming Foundation. And I was wondering about that organization. First of all, is there any connection with the Ian Fleming family, the foundation?
The only connection with the Ian Fleming family is that they tolerate us. And that when we formed the foundation, one of the rules going in before we incorporated was that we get the blessings of the family and all the copyright holders of James Bond and Ian Fleming. And they very, very much did support us and still do. In fact, I've been on total contact with them for the last week, helping get ready for this show.
And the Fleming family, just to put it more bluntly, I mean, for a number of years, members of the Fleming family were on the board of the Ian Fleming Foundation, and then they changed the name of Ian Fleming's literary holding company to Ian Fleming Publications, and there started to be some confusion amongst people when they would be trying to contact them and are trying to get official blessings for certain things on whether they were the Ian Fleming Foundation or Ian Fleming Publications or whether we were an arm of theirs. And so they said it's probably better if we're not actually on the board for, you know, certain reasons regarding things like that. But they have been wonderfully supportive of the foundation, and they have, you know, utilized the services of the foundation numerous times for numerous reasons for Bond-related projects, as have the Bond film producers.
Well, tell me about the foundation and what its mission is.
Well, the mission of the foundation is to basically preserve the legacy of the creation of Ian Fleming. And that includes not only James Bond, but Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But in primarily one of the things that we've done over the years is collect vehicles from the movies. And that was because we had one of our original founders of the foundation was really good at hunting these things down and finding them. But we also are constantly doing interviews or helping out with articles or helping people do research and finding facts about Ian Fleming and his legacy and advising people from that sense.
I'm looking at the website now if you want to look at it. It is ianflemingfoundation.org. And John Cork, you're involved with the foundation as well?
I'm very supportive of the foundation. I used to be on the board and was there when it began, but ultimately when I began working on the DVD documentaries and working on the official books, I found that I wasn't putting the, you know, when I finished work, I wasn't then going to spend my hobby time working on foundation-related sort of things. And I felt it was best for me to allow the foundation to expand its board by me stepping aside and getting sort of new blood and a new voice inside there. But the foundation is something that I passionately endorse and support, and I'm so thrilled that they're thriving.
I need to add, the way the foundation came about is back in 1992, I got a call from a gentleman by the name of Saul Cooper, who worked for Dan Jack, who is basically the arm, the products arm of the movie production people, Eon Productions, and called and said, "Hey, Mike, you want a submarine?" And I hesitated, and he said, "You know, we've got a 23-foot submarine from For Your Eyes Only that we need to get rid of, and I know you collect." And I said, "Well, you know, Saul, I collect books, but I'm not going to turn that submarine down." So I hung up the phone, and I called John immediately and said, "John, I got an idea. We've got this submarine out there. How about we start a nonprofit foundation if we can get the blessings of all the copyright holders and to preserve the legacy?" We then also called Doug Redenius, who lives here in Illinois, who is a great memorabilia collector. And the three of us incorporated this nonprofit foundation, and it's still running today and just keeps growing.
It sounds like Michael, your larger interest, you had, of course, first seen Goldfinger as a kid, but the publicity materials I saw mentioned you coming across the books actually years later and then finding out that they weren't all in print in the U.S., which surprised me.
Yes, at least I haven't really run that to ground, but what I can say is that when I started reading when I was 30 years old, And being an engineer, I like to say that I never read till I was 30. But what that really means is I never read fiction till I was 30. I couldn't find the books in Santa Barbara. And, you know, I could find a few of the Signet paperbacks in some used bookstores. But it is, my wife was in New York City at the time, and she wandered into a rare book dealership, the Mysterious Bookshop in Manhattan. And proprietor Otto Penzler sold her a British first edition of You Only Live Twice that had been owned by Sammy Davis Jr. and signed by Sammy Davis Jr. for $30, believe it or not. She brought it home. A week later, that proprietor called me and said, "Hey, Mike, if you like that one, I got more," you know, sort of like a good cocaine dealer. And I've been hooked ever since. But I think I have the collector's gene in me anyhow. And so I bought the first edition so I could read them. And it just got out of hand after that.
There were how many James Bond books by Ian Fleming?
There were 14. 12 of them were novels. 2 of them were collections of short stories.
How did he come to write them? He was he already had a day job, I understand.
Yes, he was foreign manager for Kimsley Newspapers. Kimsley Newspapers published the Times, or the Sunday Times, and several newspapers in England. He always wanted to write. He wanted to tell stories. But in 1952, he had an impending marriage coming up. And depending on who you listen to, basically Fleming himself said that he started writing, finally sat down and wrote Casino Royale to take his mind off the boredom of the impending marriage and the fear of impending marriage. His wife says she's the one that actually pushed him into it to give him something to do instead of just sit around and being nervous. But he knocked it off in 6 weeks, roughly. And, you know, so it's clearly been forming in his mind for a long time.
Yeah, during World War II, when he was working as the assistant to the director of Naval Intelligence, Fleming used to say people, you know, when the war was over, he was going to write the spy story to end all spy stories. And he purchased this estate in Jamaica, built a house called Goldeneye, built it into his contract with the Kimsley Newspapers that he could go there for 4 to 6 weeks every year to tend to what he wanted to tend to at the estate, which is a pretty luxurious contract for someone who'd never really been a successful journalist before. You know, didn't have any sort of great, you know, fame or power that he seemed to earn in the marketplace at that point. But he managed to get this deal, and you know, he didn't write much at all, certainly not anything of any great significance, before Casino Royale, you know, when it came to something that just wasn't his journalism work. And ultimately, there was one historical incident that prompted him, that gave him a structure to take these war stories and put them in a modern context. And that was the defection of the Cambridge spies. The Cambridge spies were these two young men who, you know, had come from the right sort of people. They were very high up in British intelligence, and they went missing, and they were the case of the missing spies. And then they, you know, nobody knew what had happened to them, and there was this huge speculation. Everybody knew that they had defected, but they didn't know how they'd defected. That they defected under force. What had made people who were of, you know, Fleming's class and everything like this go to the other side? And Fleming really explores that in the novel Casino Royale through the character of Vesper Lynn, who is Bond's confidant and ends up, you know, we discover, this is a major spoiler, turn your radio down if you don't want to know something about the ending, ends up, you know, we find out having been a Soviet agent. And we find out the reason that she's been a Soviet agent. And this was Fleming's rationale for what would make someone who lived in the West turn to the East. And so there's a lot of talking in the novel at a certain point, a lot of discussion of what is the right side in this Cold War. And it is through discovering the reason that this woman, Vesper Lynn, has turned against her country, has caused Bond so much pain and personal anguish, that Bond makes his declaration, which motivates him throughout his literary career, which is that he will not go after the spies. He will go after the hand that holds the gun and the whip, the people that make the spies, make the folks who are going to betray their country. And it's a quite moving passage there at the end of the novel.
And Ian Fleming keeps Bond on that direction during the books that he writes?
Absolutely, absolutely. He Bond is someone who, you know, there's a line from one of the films, you know, the little fish I throw back into the sea, that Bond sort of quips at a certain point, and that's a different kind of encapsulation. Bond is after the big fish. Bond is after the great forces of evil in our society, whatever color they may be. That's what inspires Bond's passion, gives him a desire, a willingness to put his life in danger, to take great risk, and to go to extra lengths to take on these great, you know, mythic dragon-like figures. There's a lot of invocation in the Bond novels of St. George versus the dragon in various ways. He has a villain called Drax, which is a sort of German iteration of dragon. Bond is someone who is seen as a sort of modern-day St. George figure, and he's not a saint. You know, he drinks to excess, he gambles, he sleeps around with various women and stuff like that, but he is still wrapped in the shining armor of his Bentley or Aston Martin or tuxedo, and rather than using a lance or a spear, has a Walther PPK or his just own wits and bare hands that he uses to take these great forces on. So there's a lot of sort of wonderful imagery and thought that goes behind these stories in the novels that's encapsulated in a very different way in the films, but the mythology is there, and these are modern-day myths. And they inspire us because they have that everlasting mythic quality.
And that, I guess that raises the question, is that it sounds like Ian Fleming was dealing with the real problems he had seen in his experience in naval intelligence, the real, you know, moral and ethical problems. And those underpin the James Bond novels, but there never was anybody with that sort of moral clarity in real life that would compare with James Bond, I suspect, except Ian Fleming himself, perhaps looking at it years later.
Almost everyone out there who takes on great battles does so with moral clarity. We may disagree with their view of morality. Most of the time, people who have a great sense of moral clarity, there are lots of denominations out there, and all of them, that people will attend on services of the religion of their choice, and many of them great different views of morality. So, moral clarity is something sometimes we have to be very wary of, I think. But, certainly there have been, Michael and I recently got a chance, very briefly, to meet with Anthony Mendez, who was the man behind the real Argo adventure for the film Argo. I think he's someone who approached things with a pretty strong sense of moral clarity. He needed to get those people out of Iran. I think there are a lot of people out there who do it. They may not do it firing guns. They may not do it setting off large explosions. But there are certainly people out there who are fighting for what they believe is right in a very passionate way.
Just a few minutes left on Focus today. We're talking about James Bond with two experts, John Cork and Michael Van Blaricum. Our phone number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Since Ian Fleming's passing, the company Ian Fleming Publications has commissioned other authors to write James Bond novels. The author of six of those novels, Raymond Benson, will be on campus Saturday. He'll be at the Illini Union Bookstore at 11 a.m., and then he'll be performing with the U of I Concert Jazz Band at 7 at Spurlock Museum as part of a free concert of James Bond-related music. I was wondering, first of all, what does Raymond Benson play?
Raymond Benson plays the piano.
Okay.
Yes. And Raymond actually is getting into town tomorrow, and it's a little intimidating because he's going to be sitting at my lecture, where I'm talking about all everything, and Raymond could easily stand up and probably run circles around me and talking about the subject. But no, Raymond will do a medley of a 12-minute medley of the James Bond themes from the movies playing on piano.
And Raymond's a wonderful musician. I urge anyone who's ever hummed along with a James Bond theme or enjoyed listening to any of those to hear this, because it's almost like, you know, he plays it almost like an orchestra at a piano keyboard. He really just fills up the room with his music. He's a great, great musician and a wonderful writer.
What do you think, as far as the James Bond novels written after Ian Fleming, how have the various writers done, or what have they done as far as continuing the character?
John, you want to take that one?
Sure. I think, you know, they started with Kingsley Amis, who was a fantastic British novelist who really started out as an anti-establishment figure and later became very much of an establishment figure. And he wrote a Bond novel when he was kind of on the cusp of that change. And it's a fascinating first look at how to revive the James Bond character. And Amis, you know, had a friendship and a great appreciation for Ian Fleming's work. And it's a very solid novel, but you can tell it's not Fleming. Amis is fighting his instincts of writing more character-based dramas when he's doing a Bond novel. Another person who was a great friend of Ian Fleming's, John Pearson, who wrote the authorized biography of Fleming, then wrote an authorized biography of James Bond, 007. And I find that a tremendously fascinating book. He really delves into a sort of pseudo-real history of Bond, and it's one of my favorite of the continuation books, and one of the least read in a lot of respects. There were a couple of movie novelizations, and then you got John Gardner, who was a spy novelist from the 1960s, great admiration for Fleming, who came in. And I think the first of those books are incredibly good, and then there are a couple sparked throughout the rest of it. But he was turning them out once a year, and I think that was probably too rapid of a pace for him because he was working on some other very fine espionage novels at the time. Raymond Vincent came in. Raymond loves James Bond, loves Fleming, and I think he did the best of capturing the sense of sweep of Fleming's writing out there. And there have been, I think, the young Bond novels that done by an author named Charlie Higson. Fantastic, a great way for anybody who grew up reading the Bond novels to sit down with their kids and hand these novels over, or even read them with them. Really spectacular stuff. And I think Ian Fleming Publications is doing a very good job of going through now and selecting an author to give a unique take on Bond for one book at a time.
Yeah, and they also did a series at the same time Charlie Higson started doing the Young Bond series to do the Moneypenny Diaries. It's a look at Bond through Moneypenny's eyes, written as, you know, by Moneypenny as a diary. And there's three of those as well. So Sebastian Fox, Jeffrey Deaver, and now William Boyd is coming out with they each did one book, and William Boyd is coming out with one in September. So there will be a brand new Bond novel coming out in September.
I have an email coming in from our content director here at WYLL, David Teal, quite the pop culture maven himself, and he's telling us that he misses the over-the-top villains and gadgets of the late Connery, early Roger Moore era. David writes, Craig's films might be closer to Ian Fleming's character, but they seem interchangeable with other modern action franchises such as Bourne. Given the enormous financial success of the super serious Skyfall, in which we thrill to the sight of James Bond moping about his lonely childhood, do you think there's any possibility of future films in which Bond saves the world from a cat-stroking villain with the help of an exploding pen?
I would say to that, if you watched You Only Live Twice in 1967, would you have ever said, is there any chance of a Bond film that gets back to the core of the Fleming novels and where the villain is where Bond is going to go back to his ancestral home and make any comments about his childhood? And the answer to that would be no. No, they'll never go in that direction. So you can't tell what they're going to do. But I would say that Silva, the villain in Skyfall, was spectacular. And I will take his thigh-stroking villainy over the cat-stroking villainy of Blofeld any day you want to put them up against each other.
Well, the gauntlet has been dropped in the arguments over Bond villains, and we have to stop there. We've been talking today with John Cork and with Michael Van Blaricum of the Ian Fleming Foundation, both great fans, talking about James Bond, 60 years old and still going strong. For more information on the Birth of Bond exhibit and events at the University of Illinois, go to the link at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. And John and Michael, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Jim, for having us.
Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We are likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580, streaming on will.illinois.edu. There's a replay at 8 p.m. And go to our website for a free downloadable podcast and to listen to years of past programs. Tomorrow on Focus, we turn to your questions on gardening with Illinois Extension horticulture expert Sandy Mason and Eduardo Torrealba. His company, Oso Technologies, has developed a product to help novice gardeners keep their plants thriving while conserving water. That's on Friday's program. Today's show, produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. You're listening to Focus on WILL.